It's like trying to explain to an engineer, why would a woman choose a car based on whether or not it has a vanity mirror? You know, that is a nonsensical, non-logical thing to try to explain to an engineer, but that's how people are.
Lisa Mackey says empathy is the cornerstone of customer engagement, whether it's in technology or healthcare. She grew up as a self-described Seattle hillbilly, and today is a successful Silicon Valley entrepreneur.
This is Tectonics, the podcast focused on the people and passion at the intersection of technology and health.
This is our very first episode of Tectonics. I'm David Shaywitz, the Chief Medical Officer of DNA Nexus.
And I'm Lisa Soon in Adventure Valkyrie Consulting, and I can't believe we're here. It's so exciting.
I know, we're doing this.
Exactly. Lisa Mackey's our first guest on this show, as you know, and she's the CEO of PocketDoc, a company building a platform for the business of health. She's also a friend, and I'm on her board of directors, so it's exciting to have her as our first guest.
I can only imagine what those board meetings must be like.
Yeah, it's a little scary sometimes, but this was a great interview. We found some really interesting things about Lisa that really explained why she believes empathy works as a way to make products and provide services that work in the healthcare system. We started the interview with Lisa describing PocketDoc.
PocketDoc is a platform for the business of health, so we enable real-time and transparent transactions in healthcare, everything from checking your eligibility, enabling real-time payments, to enrolling you in a benefit.
So my recollection is that the company was born in part out of your experience being unable to find care that was more about you than about the healthcare system.
Yeah, that is true. The company was born, I'm called Patient Zero at PocketDoc. I had a back injury in about 2010, and it's been 6 months with my primary care physician trying to figure out what was wrong, because they were afraid to prescribe an MRI, because, of course, MRIs are overprescribed. So after 6 months, I had one, and it showed that I have synovial cysts on my spine. They look like a little marble in my spinal column, and we had that immediately removed because the surgeon told me I was about to lose all use of myself under the under my belly button, and but it comes back unfortunately. So the next step the surgeon told me was to fuse my spine, and I didn't really like that idea, being a pretty active person. So I took another 6 months to figure out what were my non-surgical options, and in desperation, put something out on Facebook. You know, like, has anyone ever heard of it? Have they dealt with it successfully, non-surgically? And I got an answer, of course. Everyone gets an answer on Facebook. And it led me, it wasn't direct, but it led me to a guy who knew a guy.
The guy behind the guy.
The guy, yeah, behind the curtain, who turned out to be literally 100 yards from the surgeons who told me that my only recourse was to fuse my spine. And he was treating people with this condition non-surgically with human growth hormone in a study at the same hospital. So I like to say it took me 6 months to go 100 yards. And I enrolled in the study, got the treatments, and then and I'm fine.
Wow.
No pain, no nothing.
So you came to healthcare, but not from a healthcare background.
That's right.
You went from tech, I think, to come to the healthcare side. How did that transition happen?
So you're right. I started building software back in 1989. I was a contractor at Microsoft, building and making tutorials for pre-Windows versions of a product called Works.
Wow, really, and back in the day.
In the day, yes, before the back in the. When there were dirt floors at Microsoft, and
so in the clean room,
yeah, right. yeah, I got to work for amazing people like Melinda, then French, now Gates, and learn the craft of building software from the greats. I started a business back in 2007 with my co-founder Ted Tanner. It was a technical platform as well, but not in health. But we ended up selling that to Benefit Focus. They went public last year. They wanted us to rewrite their business model, data model, rather. And we did, and we took a year and a half to really learn the health domain through the data, seeing all that benefits data, everything that's happening to all of you, all your claims, all your benefits flowing across it. And that's when I had my issue with my back. And as I'm realizing that I can't Google my options for how to treat my back injury, I am seeing in front of me the reasons why. You know, the services, the underlying business infrastructure is not real time. The data is not connected. And that isn't a health problem. That's not unique to the health industry. That's a technical problem that just hadn't been solved yet.
Is it worse in healthcare, do you think?
Oh, yeah.
why is healthcare so entrenched? Everyone who's in the Valley is just so always describes some type of moment like this where they just recognize how entrenched some of healthcare seems to be and why change comes so slow. What's been your experience?
This is why the tech people like are coming to fix the shit that we screwed up, right?
Yeah, we hope
right.
So.
Well, I actually feel like we did you a disservice. When I look at it and I think, oh my God, this is awful. I mean, you took our software and we let you just go and implement it in ways that I've never even seen before. And we're partially responsible, you know, that we didn't come in along with it and assist the health industry in implementing new and improved systems. Because literally what I think is the paper systems were just taken verbatim and transferred online. You know, with no thought to how could we do this better? How could we really
Absolutely.
Take advantage of the technology? And it, in a ways, it is the last frontier. It's the hardest frontier because it has such unique taxonomy. It has so many moving parts. There's so a lot of what I like to call cottage industries have arisen around the inefficiencies of health technology.
A lot of people are supported on the basis of the inefficiencies.
Yes, they are, and they would rather that did not go away. And there's resistance to change.
But you've really existed kind of at the end, as sort of a translator, it seems like to me, between sort of the technology people on one end and sort of the users or the people who hope to benefit from the technology. Could you describe how you sort of got into that experience, got into that role?
Yeah. So I'm an English major by training. I got an English
degree. Like Harold Varmus?
Yeah. So I did. I got an English degree from Stanford, and when I started at Microsoft, like I said, I was writing tutorials, but I transferred pretty quickly into a role there where you are you have to be someone who has compassion for your user, and then be able. So I would discover what a person who we were creating a product for needed, their experience, what they cared about, and then I would translate that in a logical way for engineers to create and to code to.
How did you learn to speak engineer?
In the early days at Microsoft, there were a lot of false starts where they would look at me and tell me I was stupid. But I did. I just kept... It was a great challenge to learn that language. And I have a logical mind, so that part of it came naturally. It was just understanding how they think about their craft. And it is a craft. It's an art. You know,
do you
they're
remember
creating
some
new
of
realities.
These early interactions?
Yeah, do you remember a good story about that time?
Oh, let me think. I don't have a particular story, but what more often than not, what I find myself doing is trying to explain. It's like trying to explain to an engineer why... Why would a woman choose a car based on whether or not it has a vanity mirror? And why they have to make the best vanity mirror ever. You know, that is a nonsensical, non-logical thing to try to explain to an engineer, but that's how people are.
I generally choose based on the cup holder.
Yeah, right. Right.
Yeah, quantity or the construction.
Yeah.
The construction.
And I want to know how convenient is my USB plug-in, you know?
Exactly. Exactly.
So I can get to all that stuff. And that... to an engineer, that's a really frustrating thing to have to accept about human nature and the people using their products.
Did you meet in the context of Microsoft some engineers who you thought had a particular empathy for the customer? Someone who seemed to be, you know, people who was it distinctive? Were there people who sort of had more empathy than most? Because it seems like that would be a quality that could really distinguish a top notch engineer from someone who's very technically good, but not able to apply it as broadly.
So you have identified what most people think is the primary difference between Microsoft and Apple, is that Microsoft was created by people who have zero empathy for humans. And I was actually hired into that role by the guy who invented the role at Microsoft that was supposed to be have empathy for humans and then make sure that we created products that could be used by humans. And some would argue that Microsoft
empathizer in chief.
Yeah. Some would argue that Microsoft never did that very well. Apple obviously always got that from the beginning. You know, they created beautiful experiences for people. So that's the
Do you feel like it's evolved though at Microsoft?
it evolved for the worse. And now I think Satya Nadella is, I would never wanted to step into his shoes when he started, but I think he's, if anything, he's getting back to the core of what they're great at. Whether or not, I know he is a gentleman who comes across as, and he's an engineer, comes across as having a lot of compassion. And I think most of the engineers there, even Bill Gates, developed compassion when they had children.
That's interesting. So I was going to ask you, you know, so you went from tech to healthcare, but when you were growing up in the Seattle area around Microsoft, but not near, but around, what was that your plan? Were you, is it when you were 8 years old, did you want to go and work at Microsoft or be an engineer or, you know, and end up in healthcare? What were, where did you start out? How did you get there from the beginning?
I started out in Kitsap County across Puget Sound from King County, which is where Seattle is. And Kitsap County is where my father's family homesteaded. They're immigrants from Finland. My uncle was born in a tent.
So you're like the Seattle hillbillies?
We are. We are the Clampett family of Paulsbo. So we... I came from a rural area, a lot of subsistence farming. Lucky for me, my uncle was the first of the family to go to college. He lost his arm in a lumber mill accident while home from college earning money one day. So he was my elementary school principal, and he drove the school bus, which was a stick shift. And he had a hook on his right hand, so he had to hold the steering wheel and shift with his left hand. It's like, today, no one would ever allow their child to go on a school bus with a man with a hook.
But they were very well behaved.
Oh, we were extremely well behaved. We were all scared to death of him.
It's like Peter Pan
with his
part
hook.
Two.
Yeah.
Principal hook.
Right. Totally. But we lived in a really beautiful part of the county, and all the Bill Gateses of the world, their families own their summer homes near where I lived. So, no, I never thought I would ever work for him. We were cleaning their homes and trying to bum rides on their ski boat. We were not the ones who were ever going to work at their company.
So what was your original career plan?
Originally, I applied to Stanford, applied to Georgetown, because I thought foreign affairs. You know, I thought that sounded really romantic. I would go and, you know, travel the world, and I would, you know, do
wear
all
a trench
this.
Coat.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to be a spy. That's why I wanted to be a spy. But I got into both, but I chose Stanford because it seemed like a big enough change for a country bumpkin from Kitsap County.
How'd that work out?
It was pretty eye-opening. It was totally, I didn't even know. So this will give you an idea of how backward I was. I didn't know you could take your SATs more than once. Two weeks before we were supposed to take it, I'd never heard of the test before. And they say, show up here with a number two pencil and take the test. So I met people who had gotten out of all their, you know, they'd scored out of all classes and things. I didn't know that there were boarding schools in the U.S. I thought those were only in England. I didn't know that there were still people having coming out parties. My mother said, oh, yeah, the people used to do that.
I thought it meant they were coming out of the closet.
Yeah, right. No, I didn't know, yeah, that they dressed up and it was a ball. You had a ball, you know, regardless of what you were coming out of.
See, Lisa, that'd be the difference, I guess, between Stanford and Berkeley, right?
Yeah, right.
Totally. That's so funny. Yes. So it took me, I like to think that at Stanford, more than I got an education, I got socialized. You know, sort of like, you know, those people have been living in the bush and they find them and they can't speak English. Yeah. Right. I've done good at Stanford. Yeah.
So you were raised by software engineers.
Yeah, right.
There you are, Henry Higgins.
Yeah. Rain in Spain. Spain's mainly on the
So plane. And coming out of Stanford now, if you know, by law you have to go into tech and start a company. Is that what happened to you?
Well, when I was coming out of Stanford, Silicon Valley was just beginning. People at Stanford, you know, students, we never went south of San Antonio Road. Like, why would you? And you only ever went to San Francisco to ride the cable car and do one of those scavenger hunt things your freshman year. So it was none of that existed. it wasn't until after, probably more in 85, where they started leaking into, you know, up into Mountain View. And you, if you shared a house somewhere around Stanford, then you might be sharing one with a software engineer from one of these Silicon Valley companies. So you knew. And then all the guy, all the men and women who were remotely technical were starting to get jobs at Apple and Oracle. But to give you a sense of, like, the computer science at Microsoft all took place on mainframes. The guy did it too. We all we rented time on mainframes to do our computer classes.
So in retrospect, you and I actually both worked in Silicon Valley at that same time in the mid-80s. And did you know it at the time that it was sort of the first coming of the tech titans?
So here's another thing: is I was rowing crew at Stanford my senior year.
Wow.
And I dropped out.
Cliche.
Yeah, I know. It was totally.
You assimilated nicely.
Yes, thank you.
You are blonde.
Yeah, I was blonde. Yes, right. Brow ridge.
So, authentically Scandinavian.
Right. Yeah. So I stopped at Stanford. You know, you can stop out. They have this concept where you can leave and come back. And I stopped out the first quarter of my senior year, and I went and worked for a friend at Apple on the Lisa computer.
Named after me, of course.
No, me. And he would come by. Steve Jobs would come by, and it was during his bow tie period.
I didn't know he passed. He went through that bow tie period.
He did. He was he was the young Turk. You know, he had his suspenders, bow tie, and he was very handsome. And he would sweep through the office, you know, very dramatically. And you had a sense that something was happening. Something was going on that was huge.
Wow.
And then, of course, when I went up to Microsoft and you got the sense of the battles going on, it was Battles of the Titans.
So how does that differ from the sort of Revenge of the Nerds, Tech Titans part two that we're going through now?
It's funny you'd ask that. When I came back, because I'd been gone from the Bay Area for a long time, when I chose to come back and base my company here. When I lived here before, I lived for a couple years in the Haight area. I lived on Clayton in between Haight and Waller.
Excellent.
And
by the rock and pole.
Yes, exactly. And the Haight Free Clinic, where the Hare Krishna spent every Sunday afternoon, and, you know, all that stuff. So, and it was pretty gritty in the 80s. Not quite as gritty as, you know, probably the 70s, but still pretty gritty. And I came back to set up the company here, and I went down there, and I'm like, it's like they have actors dressed up who look like people used to look back in the 70s and 80s in the Haight.
So it's sort of like Epcot.
Yeah, it's Epcot for Haight.
Epcot for stoners.
Right. Stoner Epcot.
So there is right now, it seems, a certain amount of that in the Valley. There's a certain amount of formula to it. And people are arriving to do sort of Epcot of the Valley, and whether it's through incubators or whatever, people are going through the experience. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that, because it still gives you an experience and a set of rules and not rules, but ways of thinking about problems and thinking about creativity that are super useful no matter what you do.
But I hear the butt coming. But the black T-shirt's a little much. What's
yeah. But like anything that evolves and ages, it can get cliche. It can get formulaic. You can get a lot of the same thing. And so I believe it becomes important to continue to remind people to look elsewhere.
Has it reached parity level at this point?
If not, very much in danger of. Yeah, I would say so.
So you know, really don't fit that mold per se, right?
What makes you say that, Lisa?
Oh, I don't know. You know, well, one of the things I know you've talked about, and it makes me laugh every time, is how you dress for success, that you intentionally dress for success in a particular way to be accepted. So can you talk about that?
Well, you should tell me more, because of course now I've forgotten what I've said, but I dress much like you see me today. So let's get it out on the table. I'm a 52-year-old middle-aged woman. you know, and I started back in the Valley when I was 49. And the first thing that, and I'm as naive as the next person coming here. Like, you think, well, if I just do a great job and our idea is really good and we execute really well, everything will follow from there. And that's not it at all.
What are you saying, Lisa?
it's a culture.
Was there any experience in particular you had that brought that home to you?
A sweet one, actually. A young fellow who will go unnamed at a venture firm that will go unnamed. I went in and pitched him on. I was introduced to him by an extremely powerful VC who did agree to put money into us for our seed round. Great person, George Zachary. Still, first meeting I had in the Valley, you know, 10 minutes after hearing the pitch, said, I'm in, and then spent the next hour just asking me questions about myself, kind of learning about how I think. But he introduced me to a guy at another very powerful firm who heard my pitch, told me how much he liked it, and then said, the two floors below us house all the companies we're currently incubating at the seed level. The average age is under 20. They're all men. And I said, thank you very much. I packed up my bag and I walked out.
Why?
That was his very sweet way of saying, there is no way in hell you will ever get an investment from this firm. And it doesn't have a damn thing to do with you or how good your idea is. There's just, this is what we're looking for. This is what we're investing in. And do you even see yourself sitting? Do you want to sit in a room full of 22-year-old guys making software? Because that's what we're doing.
So who did you wind up hiring? Did you wind up with I imagine almost inevitably you probably did wind up with a bunch of these 20-something-year-old programmers.
No. So we're an unusual company. And for a couple of reasons. One, my co-founder runs our engineering team predominantly out of Charleston, South Carolina. Huh. And we did that on purpose. We can source amazing talent there.
Also, black t-shirts are cheaper there.
And the beards are bigger. But we super smart men and women and very different attitudes toward work and working on software than here. Not better or worse, just different. Very excited about working at a startup, and the cost of living is a lot lower than there than here, so they can have a great house close to the water, and don't need as much in salary. So we do that, but I also here sought people that could have, back to our earlier question, could have compassion for the people we're building this product for. The average consumer of PocketDoc is 25 to 55, a woman. She is online once a week looking for health information 50% of the time for someone besides herself, a child, a parent, a partner. Your typical programmer hasn't been through enough life experience. There's nothing wrong with them. They're making great software for people like them, typically, or people that they know. I needed people who could make software for people like them. So women, or men with families, men who'd had children, men who were married, men who had parents who'd had, like, one of our engineers is taking care of his father. You know, he's his father's primary caregiver who needs both psychiatric and geriatric care. And those are the people I went after.
Well, I think this comes up so often in healthcare, probably in many fields, but particularly in healthcare, of whether you need to go through an experience in order to have empathy, does a doctor need to have cancer in order to treat someone effectively with cancer? In different areas, you can imagine it can be, on the one hand, uniquely informative, but on the other hand, is that in its own way somewhat limiting to say, oh, there might be incredible talent you might not be able to access if you're making that one of the sort of selection criteria?
It's a really good point, because obviously some people have a gift of compassion or a gift of insight that allows them to write books you can't believe could come out of a 25-year-old. You know, some people are gifted that way. So it's not, and we do on our team, we have people in their early 20s to people over 50. So we We don't use life experience as the only selection criteria. Everyone has something to contribute, and we actually value the diversity of age as well as experience. So it's a great point to make.
So is age and having some experience an advantage, or is it a disadvantage in your current milieu?
It really depends. I mean, we have a young woman who's a cancer survivor and a parent and under 30. So she teaches us a bit about life every day. Certainly teaches me.
What about for you?
For me, you know, I'm not a mom. I'm not married. You know, our last startup, it was during the economic downturn, so that was a tremendously challenging time to get through and still have an exit, both for our team and for me financially, personally, everything. And I really had to rebuild myself after that. And I think experiences like that just gives me patience. It gives me a sense of humor about when I have experiences like
what? Can you explain one?
Do you really want to be sitting with 22-year-olds? Do you, or when I hear, you know, prominent VCs saying, you know, standing up and saying, I will never invest in anyone over 35, you know, and they're well over 35 and don't seem to see the irony in that. I mean, it's like I don't take that as an issue so much as at this age, it's just part of the landscape. It's just one of the challenges that make the problem to solve interesting.
So I was having a modern age conversation meeting through Twitter with a physician very recently who found the concept of calling patients customers as very objectionable, because she said it made them sound like they were buying waste baskets at Target. And that medicine was too complicated, and patients really weren't meant to be happy. They were meant to be treated. And those things didn't always go together. You know, for instance, when a patient wants an antibiotic and they're not supposed to have it, you don't give it to them. What do you think about that? Should patients be thought of as customers?
So I lived with medical school students when I after college in San Francisco on in the Haight, as a matter of fact.
Were they studying for the medical marijuana laws?
Yeah, right. actively, and because the former doctor for the dead ran the Haight Free Clinic, as you might know, a lot of drugs there. So I saw how they were trained. So it doesn't surprise me that physicians our age have that feeling. So I have a lot of compassion for that. I personally don't enjoy being called a patient, because I think it depersonalizes me and makes it easier to treat me based on what gets reimbursed the most, what insurance will cover, justifies not knowing the cost of things and not how much you're exposing me to in terms of cost. Justifies a lot of behaviors that are dehumanizing. So I don't like the term patient. I understand the feeling about the term consumer, because maybe it's not a
good customer.
Yeah. Or either, maybe it's not the best one to put. Like, I'm a person. I'm a person who needs something, and that's patient just makes me a non-person.
It's funny, because I listened to that description, and I hear it as an attempt from the physician not to assert sort of physician authority and put someone in their place, but as trying to say that there's something more special than you're not just a customer, that you're trying to buy waste baskets at Target or something like that, that there's something deeper and requiring greater empathy than just that something that's purely transactional. So when I hear someone rejecting the term customer, I actually think that they're trying to raise the interaction to almost a more sublime level. But it doesn't sound like the way that's
a doctor.
Well, yeah, it's true.
The reason why, I always use the example of my personal trainer that I used when I had my back injuries, and he introduced me to functional movement training and worked with me to kind of get back to being strong again. And I we negotiated the price before I went. I know exactly what I'm paying for. I'm his customer, and I'm Lisa. I have a more intimate relationship with that individual, and he has probably influenced my health for the better more than any physician except for one, my former primary care physician in Seattle. So when I think about the concepts, what does it mean to be a customer? It means I know the price. It means we we have a transaction. It means we negotiate. It's a level of intimacy and a complexity in that intimacy that if I can do that with you and then talk to you about my personal health, that's extraordinary. That's why I, as a person, don't actually experience patient as that level of intimacy. But I get what you're saying.
So is there a successful business out there right now that you think is completely nuts, that you cannot figure out why in the world people think it's promising in the healthcare area or otherwise?
Oh, so promising. My alma mater has a tendency to produce entrepreneurs that think that it, and this is really common with smart people, that think that if you just give people more information and you give them more visualizations of that information, then they'll do the right thing. Like if I just explain to you what satiation is, then you'll no longer overeat. And I remember hearing that going, that is the stupidest thing I've ever heard. You know, satiation is not why I eat or don't eat the donut. You know, it's like, you know not to eat the donut. Don't eat the donut. You know, it's, I'd be better served by something that came out and hit me over the head with a stick than explaining satiation to me. So that, and that's the kind of stuff that intelligent people sometimes, what's the word? Solipsism. You think everybody thinks the way you do.
There's this great book, Predictably Irrational by Dan Ariely. Have you ever read that?
No, but I've heard about it.
It's basically about this, how people don't make rational decisions. I think it should be required reading for everybody who builds a product in Silicon Valley for healthcare.
Absolutely. Absolutely, because you're dealing with human nature, and
right,
and it is irrational, and we're it's like behavior change. I have a lot of trouble with the concept of behavior change because I've been in software since 89. I've been trying to get people to click the button for 20 years now, and I know that the things that get them to click the button are the same stuff that get us to do everything else. It's like fear, greed, desire, sex, drug, rock and roll. It's all the same stuff.
And you know, you have a way of building those into your platform?
I do. That's our secret sauce.
I haven't seen any incidences of sex or rock and roll in the board meeting, so I'm obviously going to the bathroom in that part.
No, but it is. It's you have to, and that's the empathy part, is to realize that everybody wants to be good. Or I remember I was sitting on top of a mountain in Sikkim, northern India, one time, talking to a Tibetan monk. Here's one for you. And I'll never forget this. The religion is strong, but the people are weak. And it's like, that pretty much sums it up, you know.
So, Lisa, this has been great. It's been so much fun to talk to you today. And, again, really appreciate your being our first victim here, neither patient nor customer.
just victim.
And I wonder if you'd like to tell the folks out there listening how people can find out more about PocketDoc.
Absolutely. You can go to PocketDoc. And as you know, Lisa, we have an interesting spelling.
It's all Silicon Valley companies do.
Yes. So it's P as in Paul, OKITDOK.com. But we also have a platform site, so any company or organization looking to incorporate real-time services from eligibility to claims to pricing to health provider and physician lookup can go to platform.pocketdoc.com and get access to it all.
Excellent.
Well, that's terrific. Thank you so much, Lisa. It was a pleasure having you on our show.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.